another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first LQ story I have is that Linux Questions now fully supports tagging. And I've talked about social networking and kind of Web 2.0 stuff being implemented at LQ a couple times before on this podcast. We've taken that a step further now, and like I said, the site now fully supports tagging. While the hierarchical layout of the forum as it stands now is a great way to classify information, it does lack a little bit in the way of flexibility and functionality. And of course, as you know, double posting is frowned upon on LQ, so there's not really an easy way to both follow the rules and get something, say, into both networking forum and the hardware forum. Now, the forum layout is going to remain the basic way to access information for the main site. That's not going away anytime soon, and probably honestly never. The forums will always be the main focus. Tagging allows you an additional and much more granular way to categorize your post and to find information. So now you can put your thread, say, in hardware, but tag it with networking, Broadcom, whatever else you feel is important and pertinent to the post. So the really powerful part about this for LQ is that any member can tag any post. So you'll really be able to get an idea of what's going on in the LQ community, and therefore, of course, to a little bit lesser of an extent, the Linux community. So this is really just phase one of the rollout right now. It's definitely still in beta. As it works now, when you first post a thread, the thread poster has the option of tagging with whatever he'd like. After it's posted, every post in a thread can be tagged by anyone, and you'll see a list of your tags for each post, and then you'll see a list of popular tags from other members, not all of them, but some of the top ones, right above your tags. Then, a mix of all the tags for the posts are combined, and that would be considered the thread tags. So you can't actually tag a thread, the thread tags are taken from the post tags. Now, part of the beta is kind of fleshing out bugs and finding the ways that this is not working as we want it to work. And also, it's getting good information into the system. Once we have a bunch of good data, we have a couple of really cool ways that you're going to be able to use this data. And I think it's going to make considerably easier to access information at LQ. One of the first things we're going to roll out is the ability to subscribe to tags in your MyLQ section. So if you're really interested or maybe even work at, say, NVIDIA, you could say, I want to get in my LQ a list of posts that have been tagged NVIDIA since my last visit. Extending that a little bit further, you'll even be able to get email updates in digest format saying every night at midnight, I want to see every thread for the last day that was tagged with X. So it's going to be a great way to be able to track what is being posted at LQ in the future. The next story I have for you is the Linux World Boston wrap-up. So as I announced here a couple times on the podcast, LQ did once again exhibit at the Linux World Conference at Expo in the .org pavilion, and this time it was in Boston. We've been participants in numerous cities for Linux World, from New York to San Francisco to London and like I said, Boston. And exhibiting at Linux World is always a fantastic time. The .org pavilion is just a fantastic place to be, and it has a really fun set, not only visitors, but exhibitors too. The exhibitors they get for the .org pavilion is a very good representation, I think, of the greater Linux community. And this year was no different. In fact, the winner of the Best of Show, which was OpenSUSE, was actually located in the .org pavilion, and they were directly next to us. Two great guys that actually made the trip from Germany. The LQ booth itself this year was a little bit less staffed than normal, and this was a result of a last-minute issue that came up for a traveling mod. One of the mods had actually already flown into Boston and then got called in to do some work stuff and worked a little bit from his hotel and then actually ended up having to fly right back out of Boston. Seemed like about less than 12 hours after he got there, so he never did get to make it to the expo, unfortunately. The show was a little quieter than normal, though, so Robin and I had absolutely no problems manning the booth with just the two of us. I think the previous smallest amount of mods, and myself included, had probably been four for staffing, so I think we had up to six at some point, which six actually gets to be quite a few people in a 10x10 booth. Now, I asked around a little bit, and of course, exhibitors walk around to each other's booths, so you do get to talk to quite a few exhibitors usually. Most, if not all, of the exhibitors said that the show was quieter this year than last year. and almost all of the people that said that attribute it to the location. And this year it was at the Boston Convention and Exhibit Center. Last year it was at Heinz. And the new BCEC is a very nice building. And one definite advantage it had is that you get a lot of natural light in there, which was kind of nice. But the location of Heinz is just vastly, vastly superior. Heinz is right downtown. BCEC is kind of way out. It's a pretty far cab ride. So I think a lot of the people that maybe would have went on their lunch just didn't go at all. Getting back to the show itself a little bit, it started off with the proverbial bang, pretty much literally, when the Unisys booth caught on fire. And it's not an exaggeration, it actually did literally catch on fire, and smoke was everywhere, and fire alarms going off. And it was, for all the Linux world I've been to, that was actually something new. But things settled down from there, and the rest of the expo went as expected. And one interesting thing to see from my perspective, after exhibiting at quite a few of these, as we've said, is the sheer number of people who are either actually LQ members or at least definitively remember getting help from the site. And when we first exhibited in New York, I think the first time we exhibited, actually be 4 years ago now, the most popular question we fielded by far was, what is linuxquestions.org? And that is definitely no longer the case, not by a long shot. The sheer number of people who come by just to say hello and shake our hand is absolutely staggering to me. It's phenomenal, and it definitely makes all the trouble worthwhile, and then some. It's just a fantastic experience. So as usual, after the expo, the festivities were in full swing, and they always are. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to make it to the Sugar CRM party, but I heard from some of the Fedora guys that it was a great time. No, we did get to hang out with the TLTS guys quite a bit, and they're just a great group of guys. I can't say enough good things about them, and I had a great time both at the conference and hanging out afterwards. So all in all, another great Linux world, and I hope that we get invited once again to San Francisco, and if we are, we'll definitely be attending and accepting, and we'll see you there. One last thing while I'm on the conference note, I have confirmed my trip to San Diego for the Desktop Linux Summit, of which LQ is a sponsor of. So if you'd like to connect there, feel free to drop me a line, and I should be there for the duration of the show. Now on to the news. The first story I have is Red Hat signs definitive agreement to acquire JBoss. So it looks as if all the rumors were wrong. Oracle is not going to acquire JBoss, but Red Hat is. It's a very interesting move, I think. One that's a little bit more aggressive than Red Hat has been in the recent past. The Red Hat stock was up almost 10% on the news. I think it was 8.8 was the number. I'm going to read a little snippet from the press release. Quote, Red Hat will acquire JBoss for approximately $350 million in initial consideration, plus approximately $70 million subject to the achievement of certain future performance metrics. The transaction considered is composed of approximately 40% in cash and 60% in Red Hat common stock. End quote. Now, I think this is an extremely good move, both for JBoss, the JBoss community, and Red Hat. Red Hat gets open source. They've just proven it time and time again from the beginning that they really do get open source, I think. The end goals, and not to mention things like the community and the culture and everything else, of JBoss are going to obviously be much more aligned with Red Hat than they are with Oracle. And to their credit, while Oracle hasn't done anything crazy with either Inno or Sleepy yet, you still have to wonder what their long-term independence is going to be. And it's certainly far from secure, I would say. Now with this purchase, Red Hat is taking another step further away from being a software company and closer to being a pure services one. And they're pretty much there. A lot of people, I think, still consider Red Hat a software company, and they're decidedly not. They are a services company. But that brings us to another nice thing about this merger, is that the JBoss product offering, rolling that into the Red Hat product offering, is going to be easy because they're already a subscription model at JBoss. So rolling a subscription-based model into another subscription-based model, obviously the product suites just fit together nicely. Now, taking a step back for a moment, this move has all kinds of ancillary repercussions. A couple, Red Hat has traditionally had IBM as a very, very strong partner. Now that Red Hat has a directly competing product with IBM, though, which has traditionally not been the case, we'll have to see how IBM reacts. And so far, I believe their only comment has been no comment. Now, RHEL has always been one of Oracle's preferred platforms. With Red Hat and JBoss, will we now see a minor shift to something like SLES, which is also supported from Oracle, but I think Red Hat's definitely been preferred. So Red Hat kind of scooped JBoss from Oracle and now has a directly competing product with Oracle, so you have to wonder if that support will change a little bit there. Now BEA is already jumping on this one, claiming that they are now the only, quote, independent vendor of application servers not tied to a particular OS or database. And they've even gone so far as to say that they would potentially actually leverage JBoss in their own products and contribute to part of the project if and only if the IP model changed. So we'll have to see what Red Hat's response to that is. Now, in the end, I think this was just a great move for Red Hat, assuming that they can limit the Oracle and especially IBM fallout and repercussions. That's going to be key here, I think. If they can handle that kind of tactfully and properly, this is just going to be phenomenal for them. And one of the reasons for that, this is going to get their foot in the door at a whole range of high-end, big enterprise installations that they just would not have seen before. So they need to kind of convert that foot in the door to more subscription sales, but that's something I'm pretty sure they're confident that they can do. The next story I have is Paul Allen and Microsoft. So I had always kind of wondered why Paul Allen had exited Microsoft not only so early, but just so completely. While he remained on the board for many years after his departure, for a founder, he never really seemed to have any close ties with the company that he helped start. Now, I thought maybe it was the inequitable setup between him and Bill Gates. It could have just rubbed him the wrong way. But considering how he made out financially, it doesn't seem like a reasonable option. So recently, Crinly offered more details that I hadn't heard before. And this is one of those articles that's definitely fuel for a lot of flames, and it has internet-wide gone that way. But without a little bit more context, it's really hard for me to join in that flame fest. Now, when you own a company, it's your fiduciary responsibility to make sure that things run smoothly and that they keep running. So while the topic discussed is definitely an unfortunate one, and most people will probably be lucky enough to never have to deal with it, it is one that is just an unfortunate reality. And that's where the context comes into play for me. So it could have been a discussion of the, hey, we need to grab these shares before this guy just croaks variety. Or it could have been of the, you know, if he unfortunately does not pull through this, we need to ensure that the company survives and doesn't die. So given the personality involved, it may very well have been the former. It wouldn't surprise me, but I'm not in a position to know that. So I'm not going to, I'm going to hold off on judgment. I'm guessing that probably only Bill and Steve and potentially Paul, I guess, depending on how good his hearing was, will ever know the true answer to this one. But it could be that Bill Gates is so philanthropic now as a result of guilt being brought on by decisions like these. Or else, I guess it could also be that he just needs the tax break. Now, to me, the interesting question raised in this article is what would Microsoft look like today if Paul Allen had 50% and had stayed at the company originally. Of course, their corporate culture would just be, I'm sure, quite a bit differently, for sure. But they may very well have been less financially successful in the short term, having made, questionable decisions legally, which the current deep distrust and dislike by many of Microsoft may have been avoidable. There would have been less anti-monopoly lawsuits and less of that current let's just do anything to not use Microsoft products sentiment that is becoming kind of rampant these days. So that means that many less people, and here I'm talking from an end user and purchasing perspective, certainly not a developer one, less people could have considered open source because of that. And developers choose open source for a vastly different reason, I think, than end users do. That wouldn't have impacted developers choosing open source in any way. Steve and Bill really are creating their own worst enemy. It's kind of the crux of this and kind of the irony, too. So in the end, I guess we'll never know, but Paul sums things up quite nicely for his side, though, in his quote, "I made out okay," and at least financially, he obviously certainly did. The last story I have is Real Networks, DRM, and Linux. So it looks like Jeff Ayers from Real Networks had the following to say at Linux World in Boston. Quote, "The consequences of Linux not supporting DRM would be that fixed-purpose consumer electronics and Windows PC would be the sole entertainment platforms available. Linux would be further relegated to use in servers and business computers, since it would not be providing the multimedia technologies demanded by consumers." End quote. And I have to admit to having missed this at Linux World. I did not go see this talk, unfortunately. But I do have a couple comments, nonetheless. First, and I think this is probably obvious, but Linux is not nearly currently anything that would even come close to resembling a consumer multimedia entertainment platform. I would say 8 or 9 out of 10 distributions still don't even support MP3 out of the box. And I know people are going to say, you can just install it separately using, say, if you're a Fedora person, Livna, which is fantastic, and I use Livna. I recommend Livna to Fedora users, but we're talking about average consumers here. So if you think the answer to the average consumer playing the most widely supported and widely distributed audio format is something along the lines of first enable this Yum repo and then install the following packages using Yum, you're clearly not the average consumer and shouldn't be marketing to an average consumer. So that brings us back to a topic that I've talked about on this podcast just time and time again. What are we willing to give up in the Linux community to get that much talked about quote-unquote mass adoption? My guess is we're going to find out pretty soon now, 12 to potentially 18 months, but that's even high. It's probably closer to 12. And we're going to start to see some of these myriad decisions start to unravel. And I've said it in the past, and I'll say it again, I'd prefer not to hit 90% market share if it costs us much of why people think that Linux is good. So that brings us to what market share do I think is the maximum if we don't concede on some of these issues? And of course, a corollary question is what market share is acceptable for some of the major Linux vendors out there? So the first question is one that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and actually one that I had quite a lengthy discussion at Linux World about with the TLTS guys. I'm still thinking about it, and I don't know the answer yet. It's, of course, much, much higher than the market share that we have now. What's the max that we could reach while really sticking to our fundamentals? I'm trying to figure that out mentally, at least what my opinion is. The latter question about what the is acceptable for Linux vendors, I have no idea. You'd have to ask them. So that brings us to the next topic, which is DRM itself. Now, like most others, I really don't like DRM, and I'm pretty sure it's not something consumers are clamoring for, as he would seem to want you to believe. What they want is the content, and the media companies currently seem insistent on putting DRM on that content. But one problem with DRM is that it barely even slows down piracy, depending on the implementation, somewhere between not at all and just a little bit. But it's a major hindrance to people trying to do 100% legal and legitimate things in a way that the content industry may not have thought of. And just to give you an idea of an example of what I'm talking about here, something as simple as purchasing a song in iTunes and then playing it in Linux, which means that I have to date purchased 0 songs in iTunes because I can't do that. The reality, though, is that not only do most people not care about DRM, they don't even know what it is. If you ask the average person what DRM is, they would have no idea. But I think that is going to change fairly soon, and here's why. Now, I'm going to break people down into 4 basic groups here, and I know this is a vast oversimplification, but I think it's going to illustrate what I want to illustrate while still being realistic. So in group number 1, you have just the 100% average user. Now, group number 2, you have the person who's going to pirate everything for no other reason that they can. Group number 3 would be the technically savvy crowd who dislikes DRM not because they want to pirate at all, but because of the privacy and convenience and usability issues associated with that. And number 4 is the few people technically skilled enough to actually figure out and circumvent DRM and then distribute the tools for 2 and 3 to use. DVD John would be a good example of that group. And that's a very, very, very small group. So right now, DRM realistically really only impacts group number 3. And group number 3 is the group that I would definitely put myself in. I have absolutely no problems purchasing 100% of the software and 100% of the content that I use. But if it doesn't work on my platform in the way I want it to use, I also have no problem just simply not using it. Now, group number 2 uses the tools that group number 4 created. This is the kind of person that has 300, 400, 500 movies downloaded, and they've watched 4 of them. This group should be considered, I think, completely moot from the content industry perspective. None of them, or near none of them, are going to purchase any content no matter what. They don't even really want the content. They just want to have it all because they can to kind of prove a point. So I think 2 is probably a fairly small group number-wise, but it's, the media industry is not going to convert these people to consumers of their product through DRM. They're just not going to use it. So that brings us to group number 1. Which represents the vast, vast majority of the content purchasing public. So right now, DRM has almost certainly not inconvenienced them too much. It's still at a point that they probably don't even know what it is. They're probably Windows users. They do things in a way that the media industry wants them to. So the issue of DRM has probably not come up. However, if the content industry gets their way with some of the proposed asinine implementations of DRM that I've seen running around, they will be severely impacted. And who will they turn to when their file doesn't play or their movie doesn't load or whatever content they have doesn't do what they want it to do? Who are they going to turn to? And you know the answer to this is, of course, Group 3. And if you're in Group 3, you're probably smiling knowing that your mother, your sister, your brother, someone's going to call you and ask you, why isn't this working? So the content industry is getting greedy now. They're turning just record profits, but they still want more. But their greed is going to be their undoing. Once group number 1 becomes sufficiently inconvenienced and annoyed that they start actually listening to what group number 3 has to say about DRM, and once they find out how DRM really is being used, there really can be only one outcome. And that's the same outcome that always eventually happens when a company or a group of companies or any group tries to do something that is inherently not in the best interest of the masses. And that something is revolution. So the sad part here really is that DRM could have, if used properly, some very legitimate uses that could be very cool. It just seems that greed is not going to allow that, which like I said, is unfortunate. I do have a little bit more to say on the topic, but this podcast is getting a little bit longer than I'd like to keep them. So I'm going to end here for now. I may have more to continue with this next week, but that's all I have for now. So thanks for listening.